Is Real Talk, the Customer Insight Show with Jen Mancusi, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen to us on all major podcast channels and watch on dbtv.tv. Join Jen and her guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by VoxPopMe, the leader in video research for over a decade. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and everyone who wants to understand their customers better. I'm your host, Jen Mancusi. All products have to evolve one way or another over time, and brands can stay ahead of the curve by creating useful product roadmaps based on their insights. But what are some best practices for doing that, and how can companies use insights to make the right decisions? To discuss the topic, I'm joined today by Stephen Snell, Principal Survey Methodologist at Goldman Sachs. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you.
So great to have you on today. I would love to kind of kick off the show by hearing a little bit about your career and where you've come from in the insights industry.
Sure. I love to ask people in the insights industry where they come from because there's so many crazy paths. I don't know that mine's too crazy. I'm a survey methodologist, so I'm a survey person. It's what I do. It's what I studied. It's what I love. So people ask, you know, are you a brand researcher, a product researcher, UX? I'm like, yes. If someone's doing a survey and they want a survey to be good, like, let's talk, let's work together and make it good. So I came from political science. I was my background. I did a PhD in politics. And while I was studying, I put together sort of an interdisciplinary program, psychology, political science, sociology, worked with some behavioral economists, really just was interested in how people make decisions, how people answer questions. And so from that program, I went to do a two-year postdoc at Duke in survey methodology. And I've been working as a survey methodologist since at Qualtrics for 4 years. And I spent the last 3 years at Goldman.
I think actually that is quite unique to find someone who actually studied survey methodology. That's the rare part of your career.
Yeah, I love it. You know, for me, it was, you know, even in graduate school, people were very excited about their research topics. And I had trouble finding a research topic because I always found it more interesting to do the study and help others, you know, consult. I've been consulting for a long time because I was more interested in, like, people said, this is what I want to understand. And I thought the puzzle, how do we answer the question, was oftentimes more interesting than, you know, the political science.
That's so interesting. Well, I love hearing that. And, you know, just kind of, even though, yes, you did end up studying survey methodology, even the kind of stuff leading up to it, psychology and sociology and political science, that does often lead to this path to insights, which is maybe more common than actually studying insights, but really great to hear that. And so in your career, you've informed product roadmaps through insights. Walk us through what that means and what that process looks like.
Yeah, so when we think about products in a product life cycle, there are all these stages, phases, you know, a product starts out as an idea. And we do this sort of like discovery and would people be interested in something like that? And then it's really about introducing a product. And how do we optimize it for the market? We go out and once it's introduced, we want to grow. You know, so there are all these sort of well-defined stages of a product life cycle. And then when we think about research can really permeate the product life cycle. People ask, like, when's the right time to do product research? And it's, you know, I joke that it's the old adage about Chicago voting. It's early and often. Like, we should be doing product research all along the way, talking to users, prospective users, if we don't have any, prospective customers, and, you know, finding out, would you use this thing? You know, we have a product that would solve this problem, but do people even experience that problem? Would they pay for a product that solved it? What sort of solution are they looking for? So I really think that when we think about informing the product roadmap, it's really all phases of the product roadmap from the initial, you know, discovery and introduction phases all the way through a mature product that you're trying to maintain.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the ideal, right? That research is actually not waiting until the end when a product's already developed. How do we like think about what methodologies make the most sense at those earlier stages versus maybe what makes sense later on? Or, you know, are there specific methodologies that always make sense at certain stages of the life cycle?
Yeah, I think that there are. I mean, what the thing I would say is at any point in the life cycle, we want to make sure that we're not relying solely on one tool, right? And what I mean by that is I'm a survey person. I love surveys. It's what I do. But I'm cognizant that the survey can't be the only tool, especially when we're early in the product life cycle. We probably want to make sure that we're talking to users, customers, prospective customers in a more open format, be it video, be it group, you know, focus groups or small group discussions or interviews, really trying to get that texture, especially when we're early in the product development. But at any point in the life cycle, I think that we need to be mindful that we are collecting, you know, survey, quantifiable data, as well as the rich texture of more open types of research.
Yeah, for sure. The sort of blend of the two is really critical, right?
It really is. It really is.
Yeah. And I guess if I'm, you know, kind of thinking about I'm developing a product and I'm in this innovation life cycle at some stage, what are some of the ways, like how do I know what methodology should I go for at this moment? What would be some of the criteria that you would think about to say, hey, this really needs some qual, or this really needs some quant, or this really needs some other approach that nobody ever thinks about, right? As opposed to, you know, in my former role, in my former life, we used to hear people like call up and say, I need to do a mobile survey. And the first question we would always say is like, why? Like, you know, don't just do the methodology for the sake of the methodology. So, you know, what are some of the things you would think about at those different life cycle stages to determine what the best methodology is?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that other people would give you a very different response. Maybe not. Maybe I, the single voice for the industry, I doubt it. But for me, it's really a question of, you know, our confidence in what we know. Are we still in a really exploratory phase? Do we know what problems we're trying to address? Do we know how important those problems are to people? Do we know what other solutions? If we're in this exploratory phase, we're really trying to understand, you know, the spectrum of experience that our potential customers are facing, then I think that's really a space. Exploratory research, I tend to trend more qualitative, right? I want to start by talking to people, maybe one-on-one, maybe in small groups, so we have that interaction. But talking to people and asking pretty open-ended questions. Of course, this can be done in surveys too. It looks a little bit different because we know that asking a lot of open-ended questions is not a great way to necessarily do a survey. But you know, whenever the questions are open in our mind, what we need to be building, what people value, those sorts of things, then that says to me that the research itself needs to be open. With respect to the methodology, is probably going to trend more qualitative. Whenever we have prototypes, whenever we have concepts, whenever we start to think about how to bundle features, that for me is saying, ding, 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 let's build a survey. Let's quantify, you know, what we've learned so far and figure out what percentage of people in this subgroup, that subgroup, would be interested in the solution as we've now presented it. Or this concept, or this pricing scheme, or you know, and so forth. I think as things become more concrete in the roadmap, they lend themselves to more of a quantitative test.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I want to dig in on something you touched on about having open-ended questions within a survey. And, you know, there's always good and bad with any of these, you know, kind of approaches, right? And so I'm curious your thoughts on like, what's the right amount, right? Like there might be some questions that need, you know, you don't need a whole qualitative study. You just need a little something, but how much is too much when you think about open-ended questions in a quantitative survey?
Yeah, this is a really important consideration. And it's something that as a survey methodologist, I've talked to people a lot about. I think every survey should have an open-ended question or two or three, even if you don't want one. Because one of the things that we really worry about as survey researchers is how do we, you know, breathe life into our findings. It turns out that a lot of people don't get nearly as excited about crosstabs as we do, right? We're like, oh, look at this beautiful crosstab. And, you know, the executive leadership team is like, great. What am I looking at? What's a p-value? And you're like, a p-value is the best thing. You're like, no, it is only to people with like a stats background do we get excited about these, you know, comparisons of means and things. So what I think that a few open-ended questions on any survey is going to get you is that texture. So you have, you know, this trend, you have these measures of central tendency, whatever, right? But then you are lending color by supplementing those findings with some openness. So how many are too many? That happens actually, I think, relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. Unless you've invited people to a study and have advised them ahead of time, this is a survey that's very open in its form and we have a lot of questions for you. That's a separate animal, right? When you're just starting to blend those methodologies and trying to do something very qualitative with a survey, I'll set that aside. But for most surveys, you know, we know that open-ended questions can drive break-off. They'll cause people to quit. So what I would say is they go in the latter half of the survey and that you want to probably have no more than 3 to 5 of those things, unless you've explicitly told people, I'm going to ask you a bunch of open-ended questions. And that's part of like the introduction to the survey. Otherwise, you're going to get people, especially if you start out with an open-ended question, people are like, oh man, you set the tone that this is a survey that's going to have a very high response burden. It's going to take a lot for me to answer this survey. And so my you know, decision-making is already lighting up in my mind. And I think, what's the incentive? Do I care about this topic? It seems like it's going to be really arduous to get through this survey. I'm out. Mm-hmm. But if someone's already given you 5, 6, 7 minutes of their time answering questions, and then you ask 2 or 3 open-ended things on the latter half, I think you're going to fare much better than if you start out open it.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, like 5 to 7 minutes of answering questions, not 57 minutes of answering questions.
Yeah, I'm a stickler for questionnaire length. I mean, you didn't ask about that explicitly, but let me tell you, questionnaires should be short, they should be pithy, they should be engaging. You know, we talk so much about data quality problems in the industry, and we're so worried about fraudulent responses, and we're so worried about, you know, whenever we talk about data quality, we're normally pointing fingers, right? Mm-hmm. Data quality is bad because our respondents are bad, but sometimes data quality is bad because right? And I'm pretty passionate about that. So most surveys should be done in 5 to 7. They should be done in 9 minutes. That's everything. Mm-hmm. And if you're going over 10, 12 minutes, that's really got to be the exception to the rule. Otherwise, we deserve every black eye that we give our respondents about. Like, they're really not engaged. And, you know, would we be engaged with some of these things? As much as we believe in survey response karma, you know, like I take a lot of surveys because I like believe in survey response karma. But, you know, after 12 minutes, 15 minutes, certainly, I'm like, this isn't well done.
Yeah. Yeah, that is an area that I think we're trying. We talk about it a lot, survey length, but really getting down to those less than 10 minute surveys is tough for the industry. And, you know, we're getting there. I really hope we're getting there. I love the idea of survey response karma. But I guess, you know, kind of sticking with that topic a little bit, how are you thinking about the respondent experience when you're designing these surveys? Like, certainly survey length is part of that. But when you talk about making sure it's engaging, what are some of the key things that you think about to ensure that you're providing a positive experience for respondents in the research that they're participating in?
So I'll narrow in a little bit on product surveys, because I know that was an interest for today, seeing about product roadmap. And what I like to tell product managers and product teams is everyone that you are interviewing, and I say interviewing, but I mean surveying, but it could be, you know, other types of research. Everyone that you're talking to is either one of your customers or users, or they're a prospective customer or user. And so we need to treat them with the utmost respect. It's not just about making the survey easier to respond to, but the survey itself is an extension of that customer-user relationship. And so if I am a customer, an end user of your product, and you give me awful surveys, awful research studies, that reflects poorly on the product. And it might impact, you know, the way that I even respond to the survey itself. Of course it will. This is a bad user, is a bad customer experience. So treating respondents, not just as respondents that live in the wild, but as either users or customers or prospective users or customers, then you start to really think about the burden that I'm placing on them. Is this a good reflection of the brand, a good reflection of the product? One way that this really matters is the type of study, right? If we're doing some sort of conjoint exercise where we're putting people through this iterative thing, that's already reasonably difficult. We're asking a good bit of our respondents. So I wouldn't pair that with three other research objectives. It might say sort of one study at a time, really, and be really disciplined about what is this survey meant to do, and hone in on one or two objectives and not six or eight business questions. Because if we're trying to answer six or eight business questions, again, it's going to be a long survey. It's going to be a difficult survey. Like, now you just did conjoint, but we'd like you to do the separate pricing module. And then we'd like you to, you know, review all these brands and tell us what you think about them. That's an awful experience for a respondent, and that could cause harm to the product and brand.
And I think that's actually one of the great things about some of the developments in technology that we've experienced in the industry is that we don't have to do these big, you know, complicated surveys any longer, because the technology that's available to us makes it faster or makes it easier or more agile, that we can instead do a series of four studies instead of one massive one. And that is benefiting everybody on, you know, even from an analysis side of things to the respondent experience. Like, we don't have to pack in a bunch of objectives into a single study anymore. We have the technology and the ability to do things a lot faster and, you know, analyze a lot faster, so we can just kind of keep building as opposed to having to answer every question we have in one survey when we have a captive audience, which used to be the case.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that two of our best friends in the industry are sample and randomize, right? Draw a random sample and no bigger than it needs to be. Big enough that your results are statistically robust and you can really analyze subgroups. But, you know, you don't need to do a full census of your customers every time. You probably should not, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you have a very small product base, you should go out to a random subset. So sample and randomize. And the randomized part is not just the random sample, but also randomizing the content. I love to have a survey where, you know, there's a set of questions that everyone gets. Those are the core questions. And then we randomize, you know, modules. So the survey itself becomes this modular piece where, you know, some respondents are going to do this set of questions and others are going to do this questions. And then everyone answers your core set of questions. Mm-hmm. And it allows you to have this really nice longitudinal thing. You know, you can compare big groups on the questions you really care about, but then you have enough people answering each set of questions, you have good inferences. And then you have, again, this longitudinal where you can track those core questions over time, swapping out the modules as you have new research questions for your product.
That's a great tip. That's a great recommendation. Everybody should be trying that out. For sure. Now, you touched on this briefly as what we were talking about, the how to use open ends, right? And kind of getting people to pay attention to some of the really critical data. What other recommendations do you have for kind of sharing the insights and the findings with stakeholders to actually, you know, because oftentimes this person running the survey isn't actually building that product roadmap or life cycle. So what tips do you have for sharing the insights out so that people are paying attention?
Yeah, that is so difficult, right? Because we are researchers presenting results, findings to a non-researcher audience. So it's absolutely on us. And even though we are oftentimes market researchers, we tend to be pretty bad at self-marketing. So I think that insights teams do need to do a lot of marketing. And really, you know, it's about storytelling. Are we able to tell a story with our data? Because I think a lot of us are really excited to just look at the stats, you know, those descriptive statistics, or maybe if it's longitudinal, we want to see change over time. And but we look at that, you know, the mean score and the difference, and we get so excited about it, but most people do not. So using open ends and other pieces of data to tell a story. Another thing that I think is really critical is we get so obsessed with KPIs. You know, so maybe if we're in product research, we have like a product satisfaction score. And we say, holy hell, it went up 5 points, right? Or 5 percentage points, or however we're, you know, conceiving of that metric. And we get really excited about KPIs. But KPIs in and of themselves tell such a small story, right? Mm-hmm. And executive audiences tend to like KPIs as well. But after a while, they become less interesting. I remember I had a client tell me once, we've been doing this tracking program for 3 years and nothing's changed. So I don't think we're going to run it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually a natural consequence of a program where you're not doing good storytelling, right? So I said, well, what else are you doing in this program? You know, this isn't a program I'd run. What are you doing in this program? Well, we're tracking, you know, NPS, the one number you need to grow. Like, well, great. Whatever. Say what you will about NPS. We could fill another podcast about that. But, you know, you've been tracking NPS for 3 years and it hasn't changed. Like, what have you been doing? And they said, we've been measuring it. Like, but measurement is not changing anything. So I think the next step, and maybe the first step, like, as you set up that sort of KPI program, that satisfaction program to measure, you know, product health over time, is building into it drivers, things that you think are going to affect those satisfaction scores, the NPS, what have you. And that way you can start to see when these things perform well, we have a higher satisfaction score. You identify the drivers and then you go back to the product team and say, these are the drivers of satisfaction. So then the story isn't just, these are the scores and this is how they've changed over time. But it's like, these are the scores. This is what's driving the score. And as we've made investments here, we've seen this translate into improved scores. So it's all about storytelling, but it's also about using that story along the way to motivate product change, right? If we understand what the drivers of satisfaction, if we understand the drivers of recommending the product, then we can give those drivers to the product team and then observe in the future how those things are all improving together. And that's a much more compelling story than our scores went up, or God forbid, our score went down, right?
Mm-hmm. For sure. I think NPS is a great illustration of that. But on a whole, it's really like just understanding before you even go into any sort of research study, like, well, what am I going to do with what I find?
Yes.
Right? What am I going to do? Why am I going to measure NPS if I'm not going to do anything about it, right? Totally. Just for the sake of measuring. So going into it from the start by saying, here's what I'm going to do with this information. And I love the description, like layering in the drivers. These are the things that are going to have an impact on this score. We're going to actually do those things and then measure the impact, as opposed to just measuring the status quo, is really key.
And that point about thinking with every question, what am I going to do with it? That's really critical as well when we think about questionnaire length. You know, we were talking earlier about how do we stay disciplined about questionnaire length? And one thing is to limit the number of research questions we're trying to answer. But the other that you highlighted just now is think with every survey question, what's the point, right? You know, coming from an academic background, I think sometimes in industry people think, well, academics, they must write good surveys. Maybe sometimes, right? But academics are really guilty of this, like, just in case, right? Mm-hmm. So like, oh, I see you have marital status. That's a fine demographic question, but why do you think marital status would matter? Well, it probably doesn't, but just in case, right? Mm-hmm. So whenever we start to think about questions that are just in case, then we probably need to get out our, you know, digital editing pen and strike some questions to make the questionnaire better, leaner, a better respondent experience. Better respondent experience, better data quality. So no just in case. Yeah. Every question has a purpose.
For sure, for sure. And even to that point about like using marital status as an example, like there's some questions, demographic questions and firmographic questions that we actually can probably get that information some other way without actually asking the respondent to tell us. We probably already know that about them if we're getting them, depending on where we're getting them from. So that's, a big problem in the industry, in my opinion, is like, we got to stop asking people things we already know the answer to. Because that doesn't create as good of an experience. But even beyond that, like, you know, if we said, hey, we want to know this about this product or the price or whatever, but we don't actually have any ability to make a change. We have to use that ingredient or we have to price it in this way. Then it's probably not worth asking.
And specifically with product roadmaps, if we have no intention of changing a feature, then why would we measure? On the other hand, we as researchers, I think sometimes we can be a little bullish and try to get our way and say, like, look, we know that from open ends previously that this is really important. People who are grumpy are mentioning this thing in their open-ended responses. And so I think then maybe as researchers, you know, trying to demonstrate our value to the team and really trying to improve the product, being, you know, all in on the products we're working on, I think we advocate for the user, the customer, and say, look, people are mentioning this. We should ask some questions about it. And maybe the product manager says there's nothing we can do about it. Then we have to make a hard decision. Do we want to prove a point, you know, ask some questions, show the liabilities and say, like, look, that all they want is this? Or do we stand down? You know, I'm a little bit of a stinker. So I would probably say that I'm the former, that, you know, if I'm seeing an open-ended responses that people are upset about a feature, you know, the product team says we can't change it, I would be inclined with the product manager's support at that point to ask some questions and better understand their concern. And then see if we can have a, you know, a mediated conversation. Like, you don't need to throw this feature out. You don't need to completely overhaul it. You just need to do these small tweaks. Then I think we can add value as researchers in a way that maybe the product team wasn't aware of, maybe didn't want initially, but it could be a huge value for the product to have that insight.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. Sometimes you gotta push the agenda a little further to make sure you're, you know, speaking on behalf of the customer, as you mentioned.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things we talked about, I'm sorry, Jen, but I wanted to return to that question of like, well, when's the right time to do research? And I said early and often. And I've gotten a lot of pushback in my career from product managers that say, it's not the right time to do research because we're going to roll out this new set of features. We're going to roll out this new functionality, this new whatever. And so we can't do it now. That's absolutely the wrong idea. It's wrongheaded, right? If you're going to make massive improvements to a product, let's measure satisfaction now. Let's measure ease of use, usability. Let's measure likelihood to recommend. Whatever you think matters, let's measure it now. Make the improvements, roll out the new features, the new functionality, and then measure it again. You know, maybe this is my recovering academic, you know, my former political scientist, but nothing thrills my soul in product research like a good pre-post design. Let's figure out the baseline. Let's measure again, because that helps me as a researcher help you as a product manager say, yeah, what we did mattered. We rolled out this new feature set and look at the difference, right? That's storytelling, but it's also just good product management.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Love that. And I guess I'm curious too, now that we're talking about kind of all the different things that we want to measure at different times, like, how do you gauge as a survey methodologist or as an insights person that you've had the impact on the product roadmap that you intend to? How do you know that you've really helped to shape the direction of the product that's being developed?
Yeah, I mean, let's wax existential for just a moment. Yeah. you know, that's, we talked about, like, maybe researchers were not always great at marketing, and this is, you know, another extension of that. So how do we identify our wins? You know, different groups are going to say different things here. You know, I remember a team that was trying to count JIRA stories, and you know, this is, you know, the product team and the developers prioritize this thing based on our research. And that might be a really good way to do it, right? Is, you know, every piece of research that informs an engineering or developer work is a win for a researcher. Absolutely. I mean, I think the other thing is in this longitudinal research that we have not absolute control over, but we have a lot of control over, you know, this time one, time two, time three, time four. If we can continue that story and say, look, we found out that onboarding was awful. We talked to the product team about onboarding. They made the improvements. That's obviously a huge win if we can then say the improvements led to greater satisfaction, higher renewal rates, right? If we can show that those business outcomes were affected by product changes that were informed by research, it does become a little bit of a chain, but wow, what a win that is. We as researchers said this was a problem. We researched it with the users, the customers, found out what they wanted. You implemented it. Everyone's happier. Well, holy smokes. Bonuses for everybody. I mean, that's the ultimate win, I think, is research-informed product. Product made a change. Users are happier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, I mean, you make it sound easy, kind of. But it's really hard to tie that insight in with the business outcome.
Yeah, it is.
But it's the most
important part. But we have to be really ruthless about it as researchers.
Yeah. Do you think we are enough?
No, we're not at all. We're not at all. You know, if your research team is ever like sitting down and like, how do we demonstrate value? Like that means we're not doing enough, right? If we have to have those big conversations, they're probably coming, you know, too late, right? Yeah. But I think with, as we plan research, you know, you talked about every question should have a purpose. Every study should have a purpose. As we plan research, we should be thinking about how are we going to take this back to the business? And, you know, how are we going to advocate for customers, for users, improve the product? Mm-hmm. If we're doing our research and plotting along and then saying like, how do we have a greater impact? We've gone about it all, you know, backwards. It's in the research planning phase that we should be thinking about why would we even run this study in the first place? Mm-hmm. What's it going to do? What's going to be the business impact? I mean, there's so much, you know, about there's an idea in survey research and experiments about pre-registering ideas. You know, if I register an experiment and say what the point of it is, then I can't say afterwards that it was doing something else, right? But I think as researchers working in insights in companies, like if we say ahead of time, this is the point of the study, we make it clear what the point of the study is, then we collect the data and we just execute on that original plan. This study was to inform pricing, right? This study was to inform packaging, whatever it is. We say at the outset what we're doing, and then we have to just follow through and do it. And then not have these, you know, Monday morning, like, why are we here? What are we doing?
Yeah. Are we doing what we need to do for the business? Yeah. Thoughts, right? It's so critical. So, well, great. This has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining and sharing with all of us your expertise.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Jen.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening in. We're going to return with another episode next week. I'll be speaking with Insights Pro Greg Ambrose. We'll see you then.